Good afternoon. You are tuned to KTOO, and this is Juno Afternoon for Tuesday, July 30th. My name is Martha Moore. Coming up in the next hour, we'll get an update on the Wild Image Project with Daniel Fox and Nathaniel Stevens. We'll learn about this weekend's Blueberry Arts Festival in Ketchikan. Kelly Sorensen will educate us about Alaska's Learning Early Learning Network, and we'll get an overview of the Juno Public Library System with Director Robert Barr. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. The forecast today is calling for sunny, highs around 81, and tomorrow, partly cloudy, highs around 73.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Iron County Board in Wisconsin meets tonight and may authorize its district attorney to press charges against a tribal harvest camp. A vote was held last week to seek the charges. The move needs full county board approval. Mike Simonson reports.
Last May, the Lacouderay Harvest Camp got approval from the Iron County Forestry Committee for a one-year special land use permit. But the committee not only reversed itself, but also voted to prosecute the harvesters. Democratic State Senator Bob Jouk says it's time to step back and begin talks.
Without having to go to court, without having to threaten, without implying that somehow this site is harboring eco-terrorists.
But Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany wrote a letter to Iron County saying the camp is illegal. Tiffany says county forest land regulations only allow camping for 2 weeks.
When people come up to Iron County now, they're going to say, well, I don't want to go to that area where the squatters' village is. So that's suppressing people from being able to utilize the county forest as they should be able to.
LCO says 1,500 people visited the harvest camp in its first 2 months. LCO spokesman Paul Demain says they're staying even if they're served an eviction notice.
We are not going to leave until the tribe tells us to stand down, and that could come at any time or it could be years from now.
LCO contends that the treaties of 1837 and 1842 give them the right to hunt, fish, and gather in the ceded territory of northern Wisconsin. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
The Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, in Minnesota recently hosted the fourth annual youth lacrosse camp known as Lacs for Life. The camp connects Native youth with the indigenous sport to encourage healthy living, leadership, and cultural values. And as Dan Huckalack with WGZS reports, the camp also included some military influence.
As 40 campers from across the upper Midwest and as far away as the Navajo Nation prepared for their final scrimmage Thursday afternoon, Army Major General Richard C. Nash, leader of the Minnesota National Guard, arrived in a Black Hawk helicopter. General Nash says that the camp provides a great opportunity to help build resiliency in Native youth, and it is an important opportunity to forge relationships with young people who may be considering military service.
And certainly the Native American community has done great work for our nation over many years in our service of our nation in uniform.
Fond du Lac Tribal Chairwoman Karen Diver says the general's visit shows that forging partnerships outside the tribal community is a positive step in building relationships and helps support the youth.
It'll tell them how important that they are and that this organization is supporting their efforts.
Diver notes that Native Americans have the highest per capita service in the U.S. Armed Forces, more than any other racial or ethnic group. The tribe's camp was co-sponsored by the Minnesota National Guard, the University of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Swarm professional lacrosse team. For National Native News, I'm Dan Huckalack in Cloquet, Minnesota.
An Oklahoma tribe that has indicated its desire to move to another state has purchased land in Kansas. KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports.
The Delaware Tribe of Indians has purchased 87 acres near Lawrence, Kansas, but has not yet announced any plans for the land. In a news release, the tribe said the property along the Kansas Turnpike might be used for housing, child care, and a medical clinic. In March, a tribal representative said the government was considering moving its headquarters from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, just south of the Kansas border, because of restrictions it faces in Oklahoma. But the tribe has also considered building a casino in the area in the past. In 2000, a gaming plan by the Delaware tribe ran into strong opposition from its neighbors. The Lawrence Journal-World newspaper reported a spokesman declined to comment on whether the Delaware tribe is considering building a casino on the land or moving its headquarters. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney.
Today we remember an Alaska Native leader and advocate of traditional science. Caleb Pingawi headed the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and held numerous other positions, which included marine conservation. He passed away of cancer in July 2011 at age 69. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And you are tuned to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. I'm Martha Moore, and I have in the studio with me Daniel Fox and Nathaniel Stevens. Daniel Fox created the Wild Image Project in 2008. He's a photographer, a writer, a filmmaker, an adventurer, and an activist. Hi, Daniel.
Good afternoon.
Glad to have you come into the studio.
Glad to be back.
And Nathaniel Stevens, I'll let you introduce yourself and tell us what your connection to Daniel is.
I'm a local kayak guide and outdoor instructor. I've been doing trips in southeast Alaska for about 12 years now, and met Daniel on a trip in the Sea of Cortez in Mexico a few years ago. So we've been looking forward to doing some work together for a while.
Great. So, Daniel, let's just start out with a little bit of background information. What is the Wild Image Project?
So the Wild Image Project is my ongoing narrative about my relationship with nature. So I go out and I do photography, I write stories that are sometimes philosophical and poetic, kind of a deep thought about our relationship with the planet. And then I do short videos. So I've been doing that for about five years. A lot of my work was in Argentina, and now I've been looking forward to stay within the States. And Nathaniel and I, we've been trying to do projects together for a long time, but timing was never right, and finally all the pieces came together and we're able to do this this trip that we just literally just finished. We're just off the ferry 2 hours ago.
Okay, tell me something about the trip that you just did.
So we kayaked from Sitka to Hoonah. It was an 11-day kayaking trip that Nathaniel planned, and everything went according to plan. I think we're blessed by the weather and the conditions. I think Nathaniel can say a little bit more about what we had.
We took the outer coast route, so we went up through Salisbury Sound and then out on the outside of Chichagof Island. We had such calm conditions that we were able to go all the way out to White Sisters Island, where the sea lion rookery is, and then continue out around the outside, around Jacoby Island, into Cross Sound, making our way up to Elfin Cove, and then the Indian Islands and South Indian Pass, and then continuing on to Point Adolphus and then into Hoonah. And just phenomenal the whole time. We had amazing wildlife sightings and beautiful sunsets and sunrises and just fantastic conditions.
And this was just the two of you?
We had actually a third party with us, everything just went so well. There was this morning just across from Elfin Cove at the George Island, where right after breakfast, in front of us, we had two humpbacks who just breached, double breaching, and that was while we're having morning tea and coffee for him. And you know, we had so many little moments like that. An encounter with a minke whale literally came like right in front of us, passed between our two kayaks, and then we had some, you know, like Nathaniel said, a couple of wonderful sunrises and sunsets. And kind of to close and, you know, a closure on this trip, on our last night in Pinto Cove, we had the orcas who just passed in front of us. And then that was the only kind of marine mammal that we were waiting to see. And as if, like, there it is.
Do you ever feel nervous about such large animals around you?
I don't. I mean, it's in my history of encounters. Your first encounter with an animal is always, kind of scary, because you don't know. You don't always know how to read the signs, and I mean, this is, you know, it's new to you. But once you start to be a little bit more comfortable, then you know you're able to relax and enjoy the moment.
So where are you from originally? I'm just curious. You sound like you have an accent.
Yes, I'm French-Canadian, so I was come from Quebec, and then I've been living in the States for about 15 years mm-hmm. between several cities, West Coast, East Coast, but now I'm primarily based in the Bay Area, San Francisco.
So what is it about you or your upbringing that made you want to dedicate yourself, at least for now, to this project?
I've grown up in the woods. I was a scout, and my parents have always told me, you know, on the weekends, get out of the house and don't come back until 8 or in dinner. And I would just go and explore and find critters and come back and put them in an aquarium and build all kind of things. And for me, there's always been more of there's a sanity that I find in nature that I don't always find back in the real world. For me, things are actually simpler. You know, it is what it is. You don't have to really crack your head trying to find the meaning. And, you know, you have to deal with what you have and what's given to you. So it's, I think it's a simplicity that I think we've lost, and I try to find back, and I try to tell people some of the teachings that usually you have when you spend time in nature.
What do you hope to accomplish by working at this project?
Just mostly the people tell me that I bring them these little moments of these little memories or inspirations. I'm like the connection between their world, because it would be kind of ridiculous to expect that everybody can just give up their work and start to do what we do. But if we can just be the bridge between this world, you know, the environment, nature, and their, you know, work environment, and make them remember of that other dimension, then I've been successful. We've been successful at what we do.
I think a lot of people think of nature as being something apart from them. And I, when I read about you and about what you were doing, it seemed like you have a different philosophy about that.
Yeah, I talk, and sometimes I wrote about a relationship with nature, and it's not this like recent situation. It's been going on for a long time, and even our approach right now to nature is either it's a resource that we need to harvest. We always see ourselves at the top of the chain. It's our responsibility to manage the earth. It's our responsibility to harvest. Like there's a lot of guilt involved, and there's a lot of stewardship involved, and it's always us being at the top of everything, when in reality we're just part of the ecosystem. We're part of, it's a dynamic environment, and we have to understand this reality, that we're not separated from it. We're just part of it, and it's a different approach to it.
And also what I read about you is you're something of an environmental activist, but sort of without the confrontation or the message of doom that we're so used to.
No, we're not. I mean, we're doomed because... a lot of people think that we're doomed because we have our nose right up to it. I mean, right in it. But it's... If we look at time around us, if we look at how change happens... You know, we're a physical species. We need to feel the consequences of our actions to change. And that's the process of learning, of changing. And we're in that process right now. And, you know, our world right now is no worse or better than before. And it's going to be good. I mean, there's going to be adjustments. But for me, I've always preferred, and it's the same thing with education or children. I prefer to inspire and take the philosophy of bringing hope rather than having more of a negative and the cane of guilt where people, you know, have to change because of fear, out of fear. I don't think that it's a strategy that works. It might work while, you know, they're there, but they're not, as soon as you turn your back, they'll just kind of move on.
So what do you have planned for the future?
Well, Nathaniel and I are starting this company together, this adventure company, and maybe he wants to say a few words.
Yeah, part of our goal on this trip, it was a fun trip, but we were taking a lot of photos and videos and also scouting some locations. And we were seeking permission from the Forest Service to do some of the trips in Southeast Alaska, kayak trips that most people don't normally get to see, and maybe present some things to people who have some kayak skills already but would like to go with a guide, feel more a little bit more comfortable going with a guide, but have some skills to do something a little bit more challenging. Also, we want to combine photography and photo workshops with kayak trips and also kayak skill training. So we're going to try to put together some trips for summer of 2014 that maybe are a little bit different than what other people in this area are doing.
Sounds like a wonderful combination.
Yeah, we're going to spread ourselves in Alaska, kind of try to reach all the places from the Aleutians to the north to the Arctic and all the way here.
And it's a very big state.
It's really big and beautiful, and there's so much to do.
Where can people go to find out more about your photography, your writing, your adventures, everything?
They can find everything on the Wild Image Project, and for our expedition, the website is going to come out soon. Should we just go ahead and give the name?
Yeah, we picked a name the other night. It's going to be Narwhal Adventures.
Oh.
Narwhal Adventures. So the site will come up soon. Press release will come up soon.
Okay.
There's going to be the end of 2013 is going to be really interesting, and 2014 is going to be even better.
Yeah, I'll look for that.
Absolutely.
And thank you so much for coming in. I wish you a lot of success with the project and safe travels.
Well, if this trip was an omen to what's coming up, I can tell you it's going to be a sweet ride.
Yeah, well, it's been we've had a great summer here, and but you know, you see different things in all different weathers.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you know that. Okay, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, July 30th, 2013. It's the birthday of American blues guitarist Buddy Guy, born in Letchworth, Louisiana in 1936. At the age of 13, he made his own guitar, learned to play it by listening to the records of people like John Lee Hooker. He soon began playing clubs in Baton Rouge. He moved to Chicago, and that's where Muddy Waters discovered him, took him under his wing, and got him a gig. He was popular in the 1960s, both as a solo artist and a sideman for blues singers like Coco Taylor, Howlin' Wolf, and Little Walter. As rock music grew more dominant in the 70s, Guy's career waned until young white guitarists like Eric Clapton, Keith Richards, and Stevie Ray Vaughan said they owed their inspiration to Guy and other blues musicians. Vaughan said, "Without Buddy Guy, there would be no Stevie Ray Vaughan." And Clapton said, "Buddy Guy was to me what Elvis was for others." It's the birthday of Thorsten Veblen, born on a farm in Wisconsin in 1857. His parents were Norwegian immigrants, and he had 11 brothers and sisters. He's best known for his book, The Theory of the Leisure Class, in which he came up with the idea of conspicuous consumption. Thorsten Veblen, who said, "The outcome of any serious research can only be to make two questions grow where only one grew before." And it's the birthday of Giorgio Vasari, born in Arezzo, Italy in 1511, trained as a painter, but he's remembered now for his Lives of the Painters, which is regarded as the best contemporary source of information about Renaissance art, Renaissance painters. He was asked to compile these biographies by Cardinal Farnese, a great patron of the arts. Vasari invented facts when he could not find them. He often got his stories wrong, but he was one of the first to claim that the artists of Italy had recovered the glories of classical art destroyed by the Goths, and to describe how they had done it. It's the birthday of the essayist and novelist William H. Gass, born in Fargo, North Dakota in 1924. He taught philosophy at the university level for many years and produced many books, a novel, Omsetter's Luck, several books of essays, including On Being Blue and The Tests of Time, and in 1995 he published The Tunnel, a novel more than 600 pages long, which took him almost 30 years to write. And here's a poem by Robert Peters, My Father as House Builder. Cedar poles skidded by horse from swamp to highland, stripped of bark, hauled to the house site on a knoll near the country road. A pattern in the sand for two rooms and kitchen, drawn with a sapling and a string. Cedar poles adzed flat, other poles notched for walls. We chinked logs with swamp moss, secured by slats, then plastered. We puttied the windows, scrap lumber for the roof and floors, a cellar hole in the living room, the sand fetched up by buckets, then dumped in a marsh hole filled in for a garden plot. The upper story, hip-roofed, low, built without plumb lines, tin smoke pipe leaning north, tied by guy wires to the roof. We nagged Dad to finish the walls, but he never did. The studs, he said, were good for hanging pots and clothes. The walls we insulated with flattened cardboard boxes and decorated them with pictures cut from Hearst's American Weekly Sunday News. My Father as House Builder, a poem by Robert Peters from his Poems New and Selected, published by Asylum Arts and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. And this is Billy Collins, hoping you will join us here next time for another edition of the Writer's Almanac.
And you are tuned to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. And I have on the phone line Kathleen Light from the Ketchikan Arts Council to talk about Ketchikan's Blueberry Arts Festival. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Okay, let's just start out and find out, when is this festival?
The festival is this weekend, and we lucked out with gorgeous weather. It is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Great. And just give us a rundown of the events that are planned for the festival.
Sure. Okay. This is the 38th annual Blueberry Arts Festival in Ketchikan. It's been going on for 38 years. We've expanded to a three-day festival, and we start on Friday with our Pet and Doll Parade, which is a sweet little parade we have for the young folks in Ketchikan and their pets and their best friends that are inanimate. So they go marching down our main street, and we'll end up at the fire station and be able to climb around on fire trucks and police cars and have a great start to our festival. We also, on Friday, we have our Best Blueberry Dish Contest, where all the culinary artists of Ketchikan bring their creations to the Main Street Gallery, and we have a little contest for them. We then serve those delectables at the opening of our Blueberry Art Exhibit at the Main Street Gallery. And that art exhibit is artwork from all over the community, any medium, and it's really quite a varied show, and that exhibit is up in the gallery all through the month of August. Also on Friday, we have the opening of our Giggle Feet Dance Festival at the K-High Auditorium. And that dance festival has been going on for 16 years. And we have choreographers and dancers from the community that put on this great, great dance festival show. We do it two nights, Friday and Sunday night, and it's really quite spectacular. And then we go to Saturday, and we have a whole slew of activities for the community to participate in. We have fun runs. We have a huge slug contest, so kids can bring big slugs and compete for the biggest slug. And then, of course, we have over 130 artists' booths, food and game booths and T-shirt sales and all sorts of stuff happening on Main Street. We also have a slug race that happens on Saturday.
So are these slugs that pet slugs, or is it something you just scraped up on the way to the festival?
Well, scraped up on the way to the festival. Slugs don't last too long in captivity, so kids are usually out in the morning collecting their slugs. And, of course, with the warm weather, the slugs are going to have a hard time because they don't like to be so hot. So the slug race might be an epic race this year, lasting an unprecedented amount of time this year. So we have the slug race. We have a pie-eating contest. Of course, the battle of the bands with all the bands in Ketchikan competing for fame and glory. And then we have a new thing we're going to do this year, Ketchikan Underwater. It's going to be a community art project where we're going to invite the entire community to participate in making a piece of artwork that we're then going to also have on display all through August. We also have a beard and mustache contest on Saturday, which is really fun. And then we go to Sunday, and Sunday we have a couple events. The first one is the 23rd annual Richard Brodigan, Lily Ferenc, and Dick Whitaker Memorial Trout Fishing in America Poetry Slam and Sock Ice and Cane Contest. So basically it's a poetry contest.
Wow.
exactly. And that's been going on for a really long time. It's really fun, too. And then we finish up the festival with another performance of the Giggle Feet Dance Festival at the K-High Auditorium. So it's a whole weekend of events.
Yeah, I can see that. And what's your favorite event?
Oh, that's a tough one. I do love the slug race. It's pretty hilarious to watch those kids get really involved in a five-minute slug, slime across the board. So that's pretty fun. But the Battle of the Bands is a great event, allowing the musicians of Ketchikan to really get out there and perform for, thousands of people. So that's pretty special too. It's hard to say what my favorite is, but I do get to participate every year in the Pet and Doll Parade. So I do have a soft spot in my heart for that as well.
And they're dressed up?
Yes, the pets and the kids and the dolls are often all dressed the same. We have had a lot of dogs and tutus here.
Oh, how cute.
Yes, it's hilarious. And, people bring cats, they bring bunnies, somebody brought a parrot one year. So it's pretty funny what shows up at the Pet and Doll Parade. And it takes forever. It's three blocks, and of course it's little kids, so it takes, half an hour, 45 minutes for this parade to go. It's pretty funny.
So is everything free, or is this to raise money, or do you have sponsors? How do you do that?
We absolutely have sponsors, which help make this festival possible. The Arts Council in Ketchikan is a nonprofit, and so we do have sponsors. Royal Caribbean sponsors us, ConocoPhillips, Alaska Airlines, GCI, and Community Connections all sponsor programs of the Blueberry Arts Festival, so that helps a lot. But everything is free, and we want to make it available for everyone to participate. We do have prizes for some of the events, and those sponsorships help make that happen as well.
It sounds like a really big weekend for Ketchikan. Do people come from other communities?
Some do. A lot of the artists, we have artists coming from POW, we have artists coming from Metlakatla, we have somebody, in fact, the person that made the Blueberry Arts Festival design this year, Cindy Lagadakis, she is from Petersburg, so she's coming this year to sell at the Blueberry Arts Festival. So we have a lot of people from around the state coming to participate. And then as far as people joining us, the dance festival brings a lot of folks that have been in the area in Southeast Alaska for years. They come back and dance in the festival, so that's pretty special too. But as far as people just coming to go to the festival, we are so busy we don't usually get to talk to people. So we never know who's going to show up and how many people are from out of town. So
how do the tourists off the cruise ship react? Do they join in, or do they just kind of look on in bewilderment?
Well, they don't always know what the heck's going on. A slug race really doesn't translate to somebody who's never seen a slug. But they do enjoy the booths, and, of course, the Battle of the Bands is fun. We get a lot of folks off the cruise ships into the gallery to look at the art exhibit, so that's pretty cool. And basically, it's a lovely street fair for them, so they do enjoy it.
Well, good luck with your festival, and hope
thank
that
so
the
much.
Good weather holds.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on the show today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Okay.
This is Bird Note. Many of our birds can be found in ecotones, the borders between two habitats, like indigo buntings, which breed in the ecotone between forest and meadow. They use resources available in either habitat. Indigo buntings are common in Musketetuck National Wildlife Refuge in Indiana. There, grassland and forest are interspersed to produce superb wildlife habitat. The buntings feed on the ground and nest in shrubs or weedy fields. The males find perfect places for singing from elevated perches at the forest edge. Female buntings know what they like, and arriving from Mexico and Central America, they search for just such an ecotone. The bright blue males are a visual delight. The females are plain brown, the better to hide from sharp-eyed crows and other predatory birds flying overhead. With the right balance of forest and meadow, this beautiful bird will continue to thrive. Is Bird Note making a difference in your life? We'd like to hear your thoughts about the show. Take a quick survey and download our new ringtone at birdnote.org. Thanks. I'm Mary McCann.
And you are tuned to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. I'm Martha Moore, and I have in the studio with me Kelly Sorensen from the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development, and she is here to tell us about some changes to Alaska's Learning Network. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how you doing?
Thanks for coming in. First, what is Alaska's Learning Network?
Well, Alaska's Learning Network has taken many forms in the past few years, but what we see it as right now is it's an opportunity for students statewide to take online courses.
Great.
Yeah.
Do all of the school districts participate in the Learning Network?
It's open to all of the school districts. We're hoping that everyone will soon be involved. We've got about 34 that have been participating so far. So the way it works is we have teachers and students and entire districts that participate. But there'll be a teacher, say, for example, in Haines that will teach a course, and there's one, a computer literacy class. And because Haines isn't a very large school, they have seats open in that class. And so what they'll do is they'll open up those seats to students in the rest of the state. So there'll be students coming from Point Hope, from Gustavus, from all over that will fill those seats in the class and be able to take a class that they might not take in
like
there.
A virtual class?
Exactly, yeah, online.
Mm-hmm. And the teacher, but the teacher is real, physical,
yeah.
And she is actually holding the class in Haines with students
yep.
who show up, plus students who are showing up
virtually
online. Virtually
exactly.
Online.
And it takes a variety of forms depending on the situation, but most have students in front of them and then have additional students that are online that participate as well. Which makes for some really interesting conversations on the discussion boards and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are the changes that are coming to the Learning Network?
Well, we were really excited to get some more funding this year through the legislature, and through that we can really expand the program. We've signed on with UAS as a managing partner. Really excited about that because they have an online teaching endorsement, so our teachers can get certified in online teaching. And also they have lots of ability to create dual credit courses. And one thing that we've been thinking a lot about is getting students on career pathways. So those, we call them CTE, career and technical education courses, will help them get a career even if they're not bound for college. So we had one this year, our mining class, which we're particularly proud of. It was a teacher out of Juneau who taught at UAS. Had some students in the physical classroom from Juneau, and then there were a total of about 75 students from across the state that participated, got to know the mining industry, and then I would say about 30% of the class got internships and are working in the mines this summer. Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite a benefit to the students. And UAS is managing it now. Who managed it before?
Well, before we really were kind of running on a skeletal structure without a lot of funding, and it was done through the Department of Education.
I see.
Yeah.
So so this helps the students have access to more classes and maybe get on a career path, and then it helps the teachers broaden their teaching skills.
Absolutely. I think it helps them both with their, we call it pedagogy, you know, the way that they teach. So I think it helps both with their classroom instruction, and also it allows them to think kind of differently about how they're teaching. Some of them do what we call a flipped model. So they think about their projects and their units in a way that the students can do them at their own pace because they're on the computer. They've already designed this class before the class actually begins as in session. They've thought through all of those things. So the students can take some time with maybe a project or an assignment that is particularly challenging, one that they don't find as challenging might speed through. So it allows for that flexibility of time with the students.
Wow, sounds like really an ideal program for a place like Alaska, because so many of our schools have low population.
Definitely. And there are other correspondence models that are very effective as well. One thing that we're particularly proud of with Acklen is that we have a lot of Alaska-built classes, and so the teachers, when they're designing those classes, can keep in mind all of those factors that make Alaska unique. We were talking about a math class this morning, actually, explaining fractions to students, and the teacher used an example for the math class of, well, in your snow machine engine, you have to put, I'm going to say my fractions wrong here, but two-thirds oil, gas, and then one-third oil to make an appropriate mixture. So just little things like that that really make it a uniquely Alaskan product and class.
And who's adapting the classes to be Alaskan? Who's doing all that work?
Those are all highly qualified high school teachers within our state. And they've come from a variety of places. We've got Wrangell, Cordova.
And this is a contract relationship on their time off, or
An extra duty contract, we call it. Yeah.
Oh.
And that's going to change also when we have UAS on board. We've been talking about different structures of ways to set it up to really get our best teachers in there teaching those classes.
Sounds like a lot of moving parts.
It is. Yeah.
But UAS brings a lot to the partnership, I imagine, that you didn't have before.
They do, and they have a lot of the infrastructure that we just don't have at the Department of Education. So thinking about things like registration, enrollment, grades, that type of thing, which we're not used to doing. They've been doing that for years.
So even though it's UAS, they're going to manage it across the state.
Absolutely, yeah. And we hope to include other branches of the UA system as well as AvTech and the smaller colleges as well.
So how many students are in the learning network?
This past year we had an enrollment of 334, so relatively small, but we're really looking to grow that this year.
And there's students that are taking any learning network class at all, even one or more than one?
Yeah, there's a variety. We have a lot of students that are taking world languages. Those were our most popular courses last year. And I think the big drive for that was the Alaska Performance Scholarship. It's another thing that we're there for, is to provide qualified courses or prerequisites. You have to take a certain number of certain courses to qualify for that scholarship, which is tough in districts that are fairly rural, and they may offer a course once every 4 years. And they may miss out on that opportunity if the student transfers in the second year and have missed Alaska Studies. So this way we'll be able to provide those APS-qualified, Alaska Performance Scholarship-qualified courses anytime.
So there must be something that a student misses by not being physically present.
That's a great question. I think a lot of people are concerned about that face-to-face component, you know, missing that interaction. And I've asked a lot of teachers and I've asked a lot of students about that because it gets brought up a lot. And what I hear from the students is I think that they're really used to virtual communication. They text with their teachers. I don't know if I'm a teacher that I would really want to give out my cell phone number, but there are teachers that do that. So they're constantly in communication with them. And it's more one-to-one, so they get more of a direct communication with their students as compared to the classroom. But they also have sessions where they'll do video conferencing, so they'll see the teacher that way. And then the other huge component of it that really ensures the student success we have found is having somebody at the school to be kind of the point person for those classes. We call it an on-site supervisor. And so that would be sometimes it's a paraprofessional, sometimes it's a teacher or a learning center representative. In really small schools, it can sometimes be a principal, but somebody just there for the student in case they have real immediate questions or if they need a little motivation to finish the class, keep them on track, that type of thing.
Is this being done in other states at all?
There are various incantations of virtual schools throughout. The probably the most famous is the Florida Virtual School, and they built a program within Florida and now offer those classes throughout the rest of the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that I didn't mention that you'd like to say about it?
Sure. There's a couple of classes that we're building that we're hoping to release in January for our second semester that we're really excited about. The first of which is a NASA course working on aviation technology. The second is a Coastal Challenge course, so working with the Coast Guard on real-life skills and career training. The third is another aviation class done through the Challenger Space Center in Kenai, working on various career tracks within the aviation industry. And then the one that I'm the most excited about is our Alaska History course. We're turning this online, calling it an online adventure, where the students will be taken through Alaska history as a first-person narrative. And it's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure style. So they'll be given questions, problems to solve, and they'll have to talk to people along their way, read the stories of the history based on the history of the people, and make relevant choices as to what they think they would do.
So I'm just thinking, what does it take to get a teacher qualified to teach about NASA?
That one, we've been lucky. We have somebody that we've been talking to who has experience working for NASA and continues that relationship. And so he's reached out to us and said, I really would like to do a high school course about this. And so we snatched that up very quickly, and he's going to pilot that course for us this year.
Wow. Well, it sounds like the sky's the limit. Just finding out what teachers' talents are and
exactly
expertise. So thanks so much for coming in, and I wish you all the success for this, Kelly, and I hope this expands and prospers and blossoms.
I hope so too. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
When I was a little kid not so long ago, I had to learn a lot of stuff. I didn't even know how to dress myself, tie my shoes, how to jump a rope, how to smile for a picture without looking like a dope. But of all the things I learned, my favorite of them all was a little poem hanging on the kindergarten wall. Of all you learn here, remember this the best. Don't hurt each other and clean up your mess. Take a nap every day, wash before you eat, hold hands, stick together, look before you cross the street. Remember the seed in the little paper cup. First the root goes down and then the plant grows up. Well, it was first, second, third grade, fourth grade too, where I had to learn the big things the big kids do. To add, subtract, and multiply, read and write and play, how to sit in a little uncomfortable desk for nearly half a day. But of all the things they taught me, of all the great and small, still my favorite was the poem on the kindergarten wall. Of all you learn here, remember this the best. Don't hurt each other and clean up your mess. Take a nap every day, wash before you eat, hold hands, stick together, look before you cross the street. Remember the seed in the little paper cup. First the root goes down and then the plant grows up. But
I've been worried. I look around and see an awful lot of grown-ups acting foolish as can be. I know there's lots of things to know I haven't mastered yet. Still, it seems there's real important stuff that grown-ups soon forget. So I'm sure we'd all be better off if we would just recall that little poem hanging on the kindergarten wall. Of all you learn here, remember this the best. Don't hurt each other and clean up your mess. Take a nap every day, wash before you eat. Hold hands, stick together, look before you cross the street. And remember the seed in the little paper cup. First the root goes down and then the plant grows up. Of all you'll learn here, remember this the best. Don't hurt each other and clean up your mess. Take a nap every day, wash before you eat. Hold hands, stick together, look before you cross the street. Remember the seed in the little paper cup. First the root goes down and then the plant grows up.
And you are tuned to Juno Afternoon on KTLO. My name is Martha Moore, and Robert Barr and Paul Barron have joined me here in the studio. Robert is the director of the Juno Public Libraries, and Paul is on the board of Friends of the Library, and they are here to give us an update on happenings at the library. Hi, Robert and Paul.
Hi, Martha. Thanks for having us today.
We're glad to be here.
Yeah. So what would you like to tell us about the libraries?
Well, I think your listeners would probably appreciate hearing about the new Valley Library.
Yeah, that was the first I heard about it.
Yeah, so we're building a new library in the Mendenhall Valley. We're working on getting the word out and letting everyone know what's going on. So we are in architectural design right now, and we'll be going out to bid in March of next year. And the library is scheduled to be completed in the summer of 2015. That's what we're working on. So right now I'm learning that there are four stages of architectural design, and we're in the second one. It's called schematic design. And in each of these phases, the first three phases, I should say, we're having public meetings where the public is welcome to come and see the latest architectural drawings and ask questions about how things are going and what the library is going to look like and the floor plan and stuff like that.
And where is this library going to be?
It's going to be in Diamond Park. That's a good question. So right next to the Diamond Park Aquatic Center.
Oh, great.
So right next to there. Right as you turn in off of Riverside Drive, it'll just be kind of the entry
location.
To that park. Yeah, we're really looking forward to it.
Okay, and so that's when do you think this will be built? I mean, I know it's probably a long process.
It is. We will begin construction immediately after bid in April or so of next year, and it'll take a little bit more than a year to be built. So we're looking at the summer of 2015 for a completion date, and then we'll install furnishing and move all our books and all that, and open in the fall of 2015.
Will this take the place of the Valley Library?
It will. We'll be moving out of the Mendenhall Mall location. Yeah.
Okay. So, what else do you have going on at the other libraries? I know I talked in the beginning of the summer to someone about the elevator downtown. How's that coming along?
It's good. We are on schedule. We're even a little bit ahead of schedule right now. We're hopeful that we might beat our target date of opening the elevators on October 1st of this year. They're coming along really well. We're excited about them. They're no longer hydraulic, which means that they won't slow down when it gets cold outside, which of course is an issue in Juneau, right?
Yeah.
They're coming along right on schedule. The cabs are actually being installed as we speak. I was just there and saw the workers, moving them up and down, and the cab should be completed and operational in 2 weeks, but we have a long period of safety inspections and making sure they work well.
Good. And so what else you got going on in the libraries?
Well, we are doing an exciting series of programming right now around TED Talks.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't know what TED is, TED is a nonprofit organization dedicated to ideas worth spreading. That's their mission statement, spreading good ideas. And they've been around since the mid-80s. And TED itself is a three-letter acronym that stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design, but their scope is much broader than that right now. They have two big annual global conferences every year where they bring in experts in their fields and challenge them to give the talk of their lives in 18 minutes or less. That's kind of their MO. And so we've been having these TEDx programs, and the X is TED's way of signifying that it's an independently organized event. There are lots of different ways that you can do them. We're doing them book club style, so we do them monthly, generally on the fourth Thursdays at the downtown library, and people come, and we watch a series of videos on a theme, like we've had themes on happiness and communication, and our theme last month was success. And then we have discussions on what we watched. Those discussions are the valuable part of the program. It's really interesting to see what people think when presented with these different ideas on the themes that we're viewing.
So I've listened to the TED Talks, truly wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
What will you have at the library? Is it something, a video on a screen?
It is, yeah. So they're video presenters. So I download the talks, and the talks are freely available online at TED.com. And then we show them, and after each talk, we discuss what we saw. And what's interesting in those discussions is that depending on the theme and depending on the talk, the topics that come up can occasionally be somewhat controversial. And that is, we find, part of the value in this event is that it is the library is one of those places where we are fairly neutral. That is, being neutral, committing to certain professional ethics like intellectual freedom is something that we agree to, that librarians abide by. One of the things that we often say to each other when we're buying books or selecting materials at the library, that if we're not purchasing content that we don't necessarily personally agree with, then professionally we're not doing our jobs well, because it's our job to represent the entire community, not just one, not just what happens to be the most popular opinion at the time. And so that holds true with these talks too. When I or another librarian is facilitating discussion along this nature, it's our job not to support any particular given idea, but instead to engage the people, the individuals participating, to encourage participation, to keep things respectful and courteous, and to really help everyone talk through their personal beliefs and opinions about these things.
And kind of be a referee?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that that goes on, sure.
So how long do those sessions go on? I mean, the whole thing, like the video and then the discussion?
It varies a little bit depending on how the discussion goes. The videos are generally they generally hit that 18-minute mark, and we watch three of them. And so the programs have been running anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hours.
And about how many people come then?
We fill up the downtown meeting room, So about 30. We can go a little bit more than that, but it's possible we might outgrow it at some point, and we'll have to find a new space. But it's been going well.
Wow.
Yeah, and nice. I should say, since I have Paul here, that this program, as well as the Valley Library that I just talked about, is generously supported by the Friends of the Juneau Public Libraries.
And the Friends gets their money through?
The Amazing Bookstore. The Amazing Bookstore is exactly that. It's really technically a second-hand bookstore, but all the books, and there's tens of thousands, are donated. And everybody that serves there is a volunteer. There's probably between 40 and 45 people a week volunteering between 2.5 and 30 hours a week.
Wow.
And they've been doing this for years. And it's really an amazing bookstore. And this bookstore not only supports programs like the TED and others of the library, but the bookstore has made a commitment of $1 million for the new library. And that, think of all the books.
At 10 cents,
a quarter, a dollar, to make $1 million.
And how much money does the Amazing Bookstore make?
Well, we already gave $225,000 to the city for the new library. We'll make about, give or take, $12,000 a month.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's
I have
amazing.
No idea.
Yeah, it's really outstanding. I've worked in libraries for a number of years, and many libraries, most libraries, in fact, have a friends group, and most of those sell books, too. And none of them do so at this magnitude. It's really outstanding.
You might be interested that there's a cadre of people that come in early Monday morning and early Friday morning to sort, price, and shelf books. And then there's another group that comes in starting at 10 o'clock to run the desk and the sales. And they're in 2.5-hour shifts. So it's just really tremendous.
And since you've moved to a bigger location, it's so much easier to find books. It's very organized. Very
it sure
spacious.
Yeah, sometimes we're envious at the library of their organization.
Yeah. So this new library is really through the state having a program of up to seven, they'll contribute up to $7 million in reimbursable grants for this new library, half the cost. The Friends of the Library has committed $1 million, and the city has put this on one of the 1% items. So it'll save the city in the long run. Instead of paying rent each month, we'll have our own facility.
So you feel pretty confident that the money will come through for this new library?
We do, yeah.
Very much so.
It has been voter approved in the 1% sales tax. And in addition to the funds that Paul's mentioned, there's also been a $300,000 commitment from the Library Endowment Board. And those are the general funding sources that we have. And the state money has come through. It's in the project budget, so we are moving along.
Excellent. Well, Juneau's a very supportive community for endeavors like that.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to mention before we wrap up here?
I want to say thank you to the volunteers of the amazing bookstore. You are doing so much, and we are so grateful.
Yeah. Thank you.
They really do an awesome job. They are super appreciated, and it really is. We really do appreciate the opportunity to thank them on air. And also, one other thing about the Valley Library, I mentioned the opportunity and to give feedback and how much we do value your feedback. So if you are interested in coming to the next public meeting, it is on August the 15th at 6:30 p.m., in the current Valley Library in the Mendenhall Mall.
Okay, thank you so much. And thank you, Robert and Paul, for coming in and giving us those updates.
Thanks for having us, Martha.
Okay, and good luck with the new library.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Saturday morning and the rain is pouring. Dad worked late last night. He's in there snoring. Same old stuff on TV. Boring. So what if I can't go out and play? I know what I'll do today. I'm going down to the library, picking out a book, check it in, check it out. Gonna say hi to the dictionary, picking out a book, check it in, check it out. Now I like books and they like me, so when I go to the library, I sit down in my favorite chair and check to see who's there. Maybe one book, maybe two, take me home, says Winnie the Pooh. And if we have to travel far, I'll bring my honey jar. Oh, I'm going down to the library.
And that's it for today's Juno Afternoon. Thanks for joining me. Thanks to all the guests today. And to listen to any of today's interviews or any other Juno Afternoon programs, visit the KTOO.org website under Local Programs and Juno Afternoon. Please join us tomorrow at 3 p.m. The host will be Laurie Scandling. We'll learn about this weekend's Celebrate Equality events. Jenny Smith from the Peregrine Boosters Club will be here with details about this Friday's Whale Watch Cruise. We'll learn about art classes offered at the Canvas in August. John Marston will be here to talk about his unique photography, that, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, tomorrow at 3 on KTOO-FM. And the weather is mostly clear. Tonight, patchy fog late, lows around 54. Wednesday, sunny, highs around 73. And Wednesday night, increasing clouds. Thursday, mostly cloudy, highs around 70. Friday through Saturday, mostly cloudy, highs around 68, lows around 51. This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon Creek and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AOA. AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BP serves Hoonah at 91.9. An Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait here KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873. We are also online at www.ktoo.org. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
It seems that the prosecution overreached and overplayed its case.
Army Private Bradley Manning is acquitted of the most serious charge in the WikiLeaks case. It's Tuesday, July 30th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. Coming up, the court-martial verdict for Bradley Manning. He's found not guilty of aiding the enemy, but convicted on other charges. Also, a Republican threat to defund Obamacare or shut down the government.
If 41 Republicans stand together in the Senate or 218 Republicans stand together in the House, we can win this fight.
And tweeting the loss of a family member. NPR's Scott Simon chronicles his mother's final days online.
I don't think it's any less sacred because it was shared with a lot of people. And it must be said, you know, there was a lot of stuff that I didn't share.
First News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. A military court's verdict today that found U.S. Army Private First Class Bradley Manning not guilty of aiding the enemy by disclosing classified military and diplomatic documents came as a surprise to members of Congress involved in national security. As NPR's David Wellen explains, the Manning verdict comes amid heated debate on Capitol Hill about government secrecy.
Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins sits on the Intelligence Committee. She believes Bradley Manning disclosed information that was extremely harmful to the nation's security.
I respect the verdict of the jury, even though right now I find it hard to believe.
But the California Democrat who chairs the intelligence panel, Senator Dianne Feinstein, says Manning is by no means off the hook.
He's convicted on 5 charges, which are major charges, that effectively...